but for Kalenli, I decide to be brave. Why are you angry with her? I ask. My voice is soft and hard to hear over the humming metabolic cycle of the vehicle. Few of the other conductors notice my comment. None of them care. I have timed the asking well. Galat starts, then stares at me, as if he has never seen me before. What? Kalenli. I turn my eyes to meet his. Although we have learned over time that the conductors do not like this. They find eye contact challenging. But they also dismiss us more easily when we do not look at them. And I do not want to be dismissed in this moment. I want him to feel this conversation, even if his weak, primitive Sesapine cannot tell him that my jealousy and resentment have raised the temperature of the city's water table by 2 degrees. He glares at me. I gaze impassively back. I sense tension in the network. The others, who of course have noticed what the conductors ignore, are suddenly afraid for me. But I am almost distracted from their concern by the difference I suddenly perceive in us. Galat is right. We are changing, complexifying, our ambient influence strengthening as a result of the things Kalenli has shown us. Is this an improvement? I'm not certain yet. For now we are confused, where before we were mostly unified. Remhwa and Gehwa are angry at me for taking this risk without seeking consensus first. And this recklessness, I suppose, is my own symptom of change. Bimnihwa and Salewa are irrationally angry at Kalenli for the strange way she is affecting me. Dashwa is done with all of us and just wants to go home. Beneath her anger, Gehwa is afraid for me. But she also pities me, because I think she understands that my recklessness is a symptom of something else. I have decided that I am in love. But love is a painful hotspot roil beneath the surface of me, in a place where once there was stability. And I do not like it. Once, after all, I believed I was the finest tool ever created by a great civilization. Now I have learned that I am a mistake cobbled together by paranoid thieves who were terrified of their own mediocrity. I don't know how to feel, except reckless.
None of them are angry at Galat for being too dangerous to have a simple conversation with, though.
There's something very wrong with that. Finally, Galat says, "What makes you think I'm angry with Kalenli?" I open my mouth to point out the tension in his body, his vocal stress, the look on his face, and he makes an irritated sound. "Never mind. I know how you process information." He sighs. "And I suppose you're right." I am definitely right. But I know better than to remind him of what he doesn't want to know. You want her to live in your house.
I was unsure that it was Galat's house until the morning's conversation.
I should have guessed, though. It smelled like him. None of us is good at using senses other than Sasuna. "It's her house," he snaps. "She grew up there same as me." Kalenli has told me this.
Raised alongside Galat, thinking she was normal until someone finally told her why her parents did not love her.
"She was part of the project." He nods once, tightly, his mouth twisted in bitterness. "So was I. A human child was a necessary control, and I had useful characteristics for comparison. I thought of her as my sister, until we both reached the age of 15. Then they told us. Such a long time, and yet Kalenli must have suspected that she was different, The silver glimmer of magic flows around us, through us, like water. Everyone can sense it, but we tuners, we live it. It lives in us. She cannot have ever thought herself normal.
Galot, however, had been completely surprised.
Perhaps his view of the world had been as thoroughly upended as mine has been now. Perhaps he floundered, flounders, in the same way, struggling to resolve his feelings with reality. I feel a sudden sympathy for him. I never mistreated her.
Galot's voice has gone soft, and I'm not certain he's still speaking to me.
He has folded his arms and crossed his legs, closing in on himself as he gazes steadily through one of the vehicle's windows, seeing nothing. Never treated her like. Suddenly he blinks and darts a hooded glance at me. I start to nod to show that I understand, but some instinct warns me against doing this. I just look back at him. He relaxes. I don't know why. He doesn't want you to hear him say, like one of you. Remhua signals, humming with irritation at my obtuseness. And he doesn't want you to know what it means if he says it. He reassures himself that he is not like the people who made his own life harder. It's a lie, but he needs it. And he needs us to support that lie. She should not have told us that we were Nias. We aren't Nias. I gravitic pulse back. Mostly I'm annoyed that he had to point this out.
Galat's behavior is obvious now that Remwa has explained.
To them we are. Gehua sends this as a single microshake, whose reverberations she kills, so that we cess only cold silence afterward. We stop arguing, because she's right.
Galot continues, oblivious to our identity crisis.
I've given her as much freedom as I can. Everyone knows what she is. But I've allowed her the same privileges that any normal woman would have. Of course, there are restrictions, limitations, but that's reasonable. I can't be seen to be lax if... He trails off into his own thoughts. Muscles along his jaw flex in frustration. She acts as if she can't understand that. As if I'm the problem, not the world. I'm trying to help her. And then he lets out a heavy breath of frustration. We have heard enough, however. Later, when we process all this, I will tell the others. She wants to be a person. She wants the impossible, Dushwa will say. Galot thinks it better to own her himself rather than allow Syl Anagist to do the same. But for her to be a person, she must stop being ownable by anyone. Then Syl Anagist must stop being Syl Anagist, Gehua will add sadly. Yes. They will all be right, too, my fellow tuners. But that does not mean Kalenli's desire to be free is wrong, or that something is impossible just because it is very, very hard. The vehicle stops in a part of town that amazingly looks familiar. I have seen this area only once, and yet I recognize the pattern of the streets and the vine flowers on one green straight wall. The quality of the light through the amethyst as the sun slants toward setting stirs a feeling of longing and relief in me that I will one day learn is called homesickness. The other conductors leave and head back to the compound. Galot beckons to us. He's still angry and wants this over with. So we follow and fall slowly behind because our legs are shorter and the muscles burn. Until finally he notices that we and our guards are 10 feet behind him. He stops to let us catch up, but his jaw is tight and one hand taps a brisk pattern on his folded arms. "Hurry up," he says. "I want to do startup trials tonight." We know better than to complain. Distraction is often useful, however. Gehua says, "What are we hurrying to see?"
Galot shakes his head impatiently, but answers.
As Gehua planned, he walks slower so that he can speak to us, which allows us to walk slower as well. We desperately catch our breath. "The socket where this fragment was grown. You've been told the basics. For the time being, each fragment serves as the power plant for a node of Syl Anagist. Taking in magic, catalyzing it, returning some to the city, and storing the surplus. Until the engine is activated, of course." Abruptly, he stops, distracted by our surroundings. We have reached the restricted zone around the base of the fragment, a three-tiered park with some administrative buildings and a stop on the Vihumel line that, we are told, does a weekly run to Corpoint. It's all very utilitarian. And a little boring. Still, above us, filling the sky for nearly as high as the eye can see, is the amethyst fragment.
Despite Galot's impatience, all of us stop and stare up at it in awe.
We live in its colored shadow, and we were made to respond to its needs and control its output. It is us. We are it. Yet rarely do we get to see it like this directly. The windows in our cells all point away from it. Connectivity, harmony, lines of sight, and waveform efficiency. The conductors want to risk no accidental activation. It is a magnificent thing, I think, both in its physical state and its magical superposition. It glows in the latter state, crystalline lattice, nearly completely charged with the stored magic power that we will soon use to ignite Geo-Arcanity. When we have shunted the world's power systems over from the limited storage and generation of the obelisks to the unlimited streams within the Earth, and when Corpoint has gone fully online to regulate it, and when the world has finally achieved the dream of Syl Anagist's greatest leaders and thinkers, well, then I and the others will no longer be needed. We hear so many things about what will happen once the world has been freed from scarcity and want. People living forever, travel to other worlds far beyond our star. The conductors have assured us that we won't be killed. We will be celebrated, in fact, as the pinnacle of magistry, and as living representations of what humanity can achieve. Is that not a thing to look forward to? Our veneration? Should we not be proud? But for the first time, I think of what life I might want for myself, if I could have a choice.
I think of the house that Galot lives in, huge, beautiful, cold.
I think of Kalenli's house in the garden, which is small and surrounded by small growing magics. I think of living with Kalenli, sitting at her feet every night, speaking with her as much as I want, in every language that I know, without fear. I think of her smiling without bitterness, and this thought gives me incredible pleasure. Then I feel shame. As if I have no right to imagine these things. Waste of time, Galot mutters, staring at the obelisk. I flinch, but he does not notice. Well, here it is. I've no idea why Kalenli wanted you to see it, but now you see it. We admire it, as bidden. Can we go closer? Gehua asks. Several of us groan through the earth. Our legs hurt, and we are hungry. But she replies with frustration. While we're here, we might as well get the most out of it.
As if in agreement, Kalat sighs and starts forward, walking down the sloping road toward the base of the amethyst, where it has been firmly lodged in its socket since the first growth medium infusion.
I have seen the top of the amethyst fragment, lost amid scuds of cloud, and sometimes framed by the white light of the moon. But this part of it is new to me. About its base are the transformer pylons, I know from what I have been taught, which siphon off some of the magic from the generative furnace at the amethyst's core. This magic, a tiny fraction of the incredible amount that the plutonic engine is capable of producing, is redistributed via countless conduits to houses and buildings and machinery and vehicular feeding stations throughout the city node. It is the same in every city node of Syl Anagist all over the world. 256 fragments in total. My attention is suddenly caught by an odd sensation, the strangest thing I have ever sensed. Something diffuse, something nearby, generates a force that... I shake my head and stop walking. What is that? I ask. Before I consider whether it is wise to speak again, with Galat in this mood. He stops, glowers at me, then apparently understands the confusion in my face. Oh, I suppose you're close enough to detect it here. That's just syncline feedback. And what is a syncline? Asks Remhwa, now that I have broken the ice.
This causes Galat to glare at him in fractionally increased annoyance. We all tense.
Evil death!
Galat sighs at last.
Fine. Easier to show than to explain. Come on. He speeds up again. And this time, none of us dares complain, even though we are pushing our aching legs on low blood sugar and some dehydration.
Following Galat, we reach the bottommost tier, cross the vehicle track, and pass between two of the huge humming pylons.
And there, we are destroyed.
Beyond the pylons, Conductor Galat explains to us in a tone of unconcealed impatience, is the startup and translation system for the fragment.
He slips into a detailed technical explanation that we absorb, but do not really hear. Our network, the nigh-constant system of connections through which we six communicate and assess each other's health and rumble warnings or reassure with songs of comfort, has gone utterly silent and still. This is shock. This is horror.
The gist of Galat's explanation is this.
The fragments could not have begun the generation of magic on their own decades ago when they were first grown. Non-living, inorganic things like crystal are inert to magic. Therefore, in order to help the fragments initiate the generative cycle, raw magic must be used as a catalyst. Every engine needs a starter. Enter the synclines. They look like vines, thick and gnarled, twisting and curling to form a lifelike thicket around the fragment's base. And ensnared in these vines, we're going to see them, Kalinli told me when I asked her where the Nies were. They are still alive, I know at once, though they sprawl motionless amid the thicket of vines, lying atop the vines, twisted among them, wrapped up in them, speared by them where the vines grow through flesh. It is impossible not to sense the delicate threads of silver darting between the cells of this one's hand, or dancing along the hairs of that one's back. Some of them we can see breathing, though the motion is so very slow. Many wear tattered rags for clothes, dried rotted with years. A few are naked. Their hair and nails have not grown, and their bodies have not produced waste that we can see, nor can they feel pain, I sense instinctively. This at least is a kindness. That is because the synclines take all the magic of life from them, save the bare trickle needed to keep them alive. Keeping them alive keeps them generating more. It is the briar patch. Back when we were newly decanted, still learning how to use the language that had been written into our brains during the growth phase, one of the conductors told us a story about where we would be sent if we became unable to work for some reason. That was when there were 14 of us. We would be retired, she said, to a place where we could still serve the project indirectly. It's peaceful there, the conductor said. I remember it clearly. She smiled as she said it. You'll see. The Briar Patch's victims have been here for years, decades. There are hundreds of them in view, and thousands more out of sight if the Sinkline thicket extends all the way around the Amethyst's base. Millions, when multiplied by 256. We cannot see Tetlewa or the others, but we know that they too are here somewhere, still alive, and yet not. Galot finishes up as we stare in silence. So, after system priming, once the generative cycle is established, there's only an occasional need to reprime. He sighs, bored with his own voice. We stare in silence. Sinklines store magic against any possible need. On launch day, each sink reservoir should have approximately 37 lamateurs stored, which is 3 times... He stops, sighs, pinches the bridge of his nose. There's no point to this. She's playing you, fool. It is as if he does not see what we're seeing, as if these stored, componentized lives mean nothing to him. Enough. It's time we got all of you back to the compound. So we go home, and we begin, at last, to plan. Thresh them in, line them neat, make them part of the winter wheat. Tamp them down, shut them up. Just a hop, a skip, and a jump. Seal those tongues, shut those eyes. Never you stop until they cry. Nothing you hear, not one you'll see. This is the way to our victory. Prison's a children's rhyme, popular in Numinous, Haltali, Nianon, and Awich Quartants, origin unknown. Many variants exist. This appears to be the baseline text. 11. You're almost home. The guards at the node station actually seem to think they can fight when you and the other Kastremans walk out of the ashfall. You suppose that the lot of you do look like a larger-than-usual raider band, given your ashy, acid-worn clothing and skeletal looks. Ika doesn't even have time to get Danil to try to talk them down before they start firing crossbows. They're terrible shots, which is lucky for you. The law of averages is on their side, which isn't. 3 Kastremans go down beneath the bolts before you realize Hika hasn't got a clue how to use a torus as a shield. But after you've remembered that you can't do it either without consequences. So you shout at Mashish, and he does it with diamond precision, shredding the incoming bolts into wood-flecked snow. Not so differently from the way you started things off in Tarimo that last day. He's not as skilled now as you were then. Part of the torus remains around him. He just stretches and reshapes its forward edge to form a barrier between Kastrema and the big scoria gates of the node station. Fortunately, there's no one in front of him after you shouted at people to get out of the way. Then, with a final flick of redirected kinetics, he smashes the gates apart and ices the crossbow wielders before letting the torus spin away. Then, while Kastrema's strong backs charge in and take care of things, you go over to find Mashish sprawled in the wagon bed, panting. "Sloppy," you say, catching one of his hands and pulling it to you, since you can't exactly chafe it between your own. You can feel the cold of his skin through 4 layers of clothing. Should have anchored that Taurus 10 feet away, at least. He grumbles, eyes drifting shut. His stamina's gone completely to rust, but that's probably because starvation and orogeny don't mix well.
I haven't needed to do anything fancier than just freeze people for a couple of years now.
Then he glowers at you.
You didn't bother, I see.
You smile wearily. That's because I knew you had it. Then you scrape away a patch of ice from the wagon bed so you can have somewhere to sit until the fighting's done. When it's over, you pat Mashish, who's fallen asleep, and then get up to go find Yika. She's just inside the gates with Esni and a couple of other strongbacks, all of them looking at the tiny paddock in wonder. There's a goat in there, eyeing everyone with indifference as it chews on some hay. You haven't seen a goat since Terimo. First things first, though.
Make sure they don't kill the doctor or doctors, you say to Yika and Esni.
They're probably barricaded in with the node maintainer. Lerna won't know how to take care of the maintainer. It takes special skills.
You pause.
If you're still committed to this plan. Yika nods and glances at Esni, who nods and glances at another woman, who eyeballs a young man who then runs into the node facility.
What are the chances the doctor will kill the maintainer?
Esni asks.
For mercy.
You resist the urge to say, mercy is for people. That way of thinking needs to die, even if you're thinking it in bitterness. Slim, explain through the door that you're not planning to kill anyone who surrenders, if you think that will help.
Esni sends another runner to do this.
Of course I'm still committed to the plan, Yika says.
She's rubbing her face, leaving streaks in the ash. Beneath the ash, there's just more ash, deeper ingrained. You're forgetting what her natural coloring looks like, and you can't tell if she's wearing eye makeup anymore.
I mean, most of us can handle shakes in a controlled way, even the kids by now, but...
She looks up at the sky.
Well, there's that.
You follow her gaze, but you know what you'll see already. You've been trying not to see it. Everyone has been. The rifting. On this side of the Murs, the sky doesn't exist. Further south, the ash that the rifting pumps forth has had time to rise into the atmosphere and thin out somewhat, forming the rippling clouds that have dominated the sky as you've known it for the past 2 years. Here, though, here you try to look up, but before you even get to the sky, what grabs your eyes is something like a slow-boiling wall of black and red across the entire visible northern horizon. In a volcano, what you're seeing would be called an eruption column. But the rifting is not just some solitary vent. It is 1,000 volcanoes put end to end, an unbroken line of earth, fire, and chaos from one coast of the stillness to the other. Tonki's been trying to get everyone to call what you're seeing by its proper term, pyrocumulonimbus, a massive storm wall cloud of ash and fire and lightning. You've already heard people using a different term, however, simply the wall. You think that's going to stick? You suspect, in fact, that if anybody's still alive in a generation or two to name this season, they'll call it something like the season of the wall. You can hear it, faint but omnipresent, a rumble in the earth, a low, ceaseless snarl against your middle ear. The rifting isn't just a shake. It is the still ongoing dynamic divergence of 2 tectonic plates along a newly created fault line. The aftershakes from the initial rifting won't stop for years. Your Sesapinae have been all a jangle for days now, warning you to brace or run, twitching with the need to do something about the seismic threat. You know better, but here's the problem. Every origin in Kastrina is sensing what you're sensing.
feeling the same twitchy urge to react. And unless they happen to be fulcrum precise high-ringers, able to yoke other high-ringers before activating an ancient network of dead civ artifacts, doing something will kill them.
So Yika is now coming to terms with a truth you've understood since you woke up with a stone arm. To survive in Renonis, Kastrima will need the node maintainers. It will need to take care of them. And when those node maintainers die, Kastrima will need to find some way to replace them. No one's talking about that last part yet. First things first. After a while, Yika sighs and glances at the open doorway of the building.
Sounds like the fighting's done.
Sounds like, you say. Silence stretches. A muscle in her jaw tightens. You add, I'll go with you.
She glances at you. You don't have to.
You've told her about your first time seeing a node maintainer. She heard the still fresh horror in your voice.
But no, Alabaster showed you the way, and you no longer shirk the duty he's bestowed upon you. You'll turn the maintainer's head, let Yika see the scarring in the back, explain about the lesioning process. You'll need to show her how the wire minimizes bed sores. Because if she's going to make this choice, then she needs to know exactly what price she and Kastrima must pay.
You will do this. Make her see these things. Make yourself face it again. Because this is the whole truth of what origins are. The stillness fears your kind for good reason, too. Yet it should also revere your kind for good reason, and it has chosen to do only one of these things. Yika, of all people, needs to hear everything. Her jaw tightens, but she nods. Esne watches you both, curious, but then she shrugs and turns away as you and Yika walk into the node facility together. The node has a fully stocked storeroom, which you guess is meant to be an auxiliary storage site for the comm itself. It's more than even hungry commless Kastrima can eat, and it includes things everyone's been increasingly desperate for, like dried red and yellow fruit and canned greens. Yika stops people from turning the occasion into an impromptu feast. You've still got to make the stores last for Earth knows how long. But that doesn't prevent the bulk of the calm from getting into a nearly festive mood as everyone bunkers for the night with full bellies for the first time in months. Yika posts guards at the entrance to the node maintainer's chamber.
Nobody but us needs to see that shit, she declares.
And by this you suspect that she doesn't want any of the calm stills getting ideas. And on the storeroom. She puts a triple guard on the goat. There's an innovator girl from a farming calm who's been assigned to figure out how to milk the creature. She manages. The pregnant woman, who lost one of her household mates in the desert, gets first dibs on the milk. This might be pointless. Starvation and pregnancy don't mesh either. And she says the baby hasn't moved in days. Probably best that she lose it now if she's going to, here where Lerna's got antibiotics and sterile instruments available, and can at least save the mother's life. Still, you see her take the little pot of milk when it's given to her, and drink it down even though she grimaces at the taste. Her jaw is set and hard. There's a chance. That's what matters. Yika also sets up monitors at the node station shower room. They're not guards exactly, but they're necessary, because a lot of people in Kastrima are from rough little mid-ladder comms, and they don't know how indoor plumbing works. Also, some people have been just standing under the hot spray for an hour or more, weeping as the ash and leftover desert sand comes off their acid-dried skins. Now, after 10 minutes, the monitors gently nudge people out and over to benches along the sides of the room, where they can keep crying while others get their turn. You take a shower and feel nothing except clean. When you claim a corner of the station's mess hall, which has been emptied of furnishings so that several hundred people can sleep ash-free for the night, you sit there atop your bedroll, leaning against the scoria wall, letting your thoughts drift. It's impossible not to notice the mountain lurking within the stone just behind you. You don't call him out, because the other people of Kostrima are leery of Hoa. He's the only stone eater still around, and they remember that stone eaters are not neutral, harmless parties. You do reach back and pat the wall with your one hand, however. The mountain stirs a little, and you feel something, a hard nudge, against the small of your back. Message received and returned. It's surprising how good this private moment of contact makes you feel. You need to feel again, you think, as you watch a dozen small tableaus play out before you. Two women argue over which of them gets to eat the last piece of dried fruit in their comm share. Two men just beyond them furtively exchange whispers, while one passes over a small soft sponge, the kind equatorials like to use for wiping after defecation. Everyone likes their little luxuries when fortune provides. Tamil, the man who now teaches the comm's origin children, lies buried in them as he snores on his bedroll. One boy is nestled in a curl at his belly. Meanwhile, Penti's sock-clad foot rests on the back of his neck. Across the room, Tonki stands with Hjarka, or rather, Hjarka's holding her hands and trying to coax her into some kind of slow dance, while Tonki stands still and tries to just roll her eyes and not smile. You're not sure where Yika is. Probably spending the night in one of the sheds or tents outside, knowing her. But you hope she lets one of her lovers stay with her this time. She's got a rotating stable of young women and men, some of them time-sharing with other partners, and some singles who don't seem to mind Yika using them for occasional stress relief. Yika needs that now. Kostrima needs to take care of its headwoman. Kostrima needs, and you need, and just as you think this, Lerna comes out of nowhere and settles beside you.
"Had to end, Chetha," he says quietly.
Chetha, you know, is one of the three strongbacks shot by the Rennies. Ironically, a former Rennie herself, conscripted into the army along with Danil.
"The other two will make it, probably, but..." The bolt perforated Chetha's bowel. It would have been slow and awful. Plenty of painkillers here, though.
He sighs and rubs his eyes.
"You've seen that thing in the wire chair."
You nod, hesitate, then reach for his hand. He's not particularly affectionate, you've been relieved to discover, but he does need little gestures sometimes. A reminder that he's not alone, and that all is not hopeless. To this end, you say, "If I succeed in shutting down the rifting, you may not need to keep the node maintainers." You're not sure that's true, but you hope it is. He clasps your hand lightly. It's been fascinating to realize that he never initiates contact between you. He waits for you to offer. And then he meets your gestures with as much or as little intensity as you've brought to the effort. Respecting your boundaries, which are sharp-edged and hair-triggered. You never knew he was so observant all these years, but then you should have guessed. He figured out you were an origin just by watching you years ago. Inan would have liked him, you decide. As if he has heard your thoughts, Lerna then looks over at you, and his gaze is troubled.
"I've been thinking about not telling you something," he says, "or rather, not pointing out something you've probably chosen not to notice."
What an opening. He smiles a little, then sighs and looks down at your clasped hands, the smile fading. The moment attenuates. The tension grows in you because this is so unlike him. Finally, though, he sighs. How long has it been since you last menstruated? How? You stopped talking. Shit. Shit! In your silence, Lerna sighs and leans his head back against the wall. You try to make excuses in your own head. Starvation. Extraordinary physical effort. You're 44 years old, you think. Can't remember what month it is. The chances are slimmer than Kastrima's were of surviving the desert. But your menses have run strong and regular for your entire life, stopping only on 3 prior occasions. 3 significant occasions. That's why the Fulcrum decided to breed you. Half-decent orogeny and good mid-ladder hips. You knew. Lerna's right. On some level, you noticed. And then chose not to notice because... Lerna has been silent beside you for some while, watching the calm unwind, his hand limp in yours. Very softly, he says, "Am I correct in understanding that you need to finish your business at Core Point within a time frame?" His tone is too formal. You sigh, shutting your eyes. "Yes." "Soon?" Hoa has told you that perigee, when the moon is closest, will be in a few days. After that, it will pass the Earth and pick up velocity, slingshotting back into the distant stars or wherever it's been all this time. If you don't catch it now, you won't. "Yes," you say. "You're tired. You hurt. Very soon." It is a thing you haven't discussed, and probably should have for the sake of your relationship. It is a thing you never needed to discuss, because there was nothing to be said. Lerna says, "Using all the obelisks once did that to your arm." You glance at the stump unnecessarily. "Yes." You know where he's going with the conversation, so you decide to skip to the end. "You're the one who asked what I was going to do about the season." He sighs. "I was angry, but not wrong." His hand twitches a little on your own. "What if I asked you not to do it?" You don't laugh. If you did, it would be bitter, and he doesn't deserve that. Instead, you sigh and shift to lie down, pushing him until he does the same thing. He's a little shorter than you, so you're the big spoon. This, of course, puts your face in his gray hair. But he's availed himself of the shower, too, so you don't mind. He smells good, healthy. "You wouldn't ask," you say against his scalp. "But what if I did?" It's weary and heartless. He doesn't mean it. You kiss the back of his neck. "I'd say okay, and then there would be 3 of us and we'd all stay together until we die of ash lung." He takes your hand again. You didn't initiate it this time, but it doesn't bother you. "Promise," he says. He doesn't wait for your answer before falling asleep. 4 days later, you reach Renanis. The good news is that you're no longer plagued by ashfall. The rifting's too close, and the wall is busy carrying the lighter particulates upward. You'll never have to worry about that again. What you have instead are periodic gusts laden with incendiary material. Lapilli. Tiny bits of volcanic material that are too big to inhale easily, but are still burning as they come down. Danil says the Rennies called it sparkfall, and that it's mostly harmless, though you should keep spare canteens of water situated at strategic points throughout the caravan, in case any of the sparks should catch and smolder. More dramatic than the sparkfall, however, is the way lightning dances over the city's skyline, this close to the wall. The innovators are excited about this. Tonki says there are all sorts of uses for reliable lighting. This would have made you stare at her if it hadn't come from Tonki. None of it strikes the ground, though. Only the taller buildings, which have all been fitted with lightning rods by the city's previous denizens. It's harmless. You'll just have to get used to it. Renanus isn't what you were expecting, quite. Oh, it's a huge city. Equatorial styling all over the place. Still functioning hydro and filtered well water running smoothly. Tall black obsidian walls etched over with dire messages of what happens to the city's enemies. Its buildings aren't nearly as beautiful or impressive as those of Eumenes. But then Eumenes was the greatest of the equatorial cities, and Renanus barely merited the title. Only 500,000 people, you remember someone sneering, a lifetime ago. But 2 lives ago, you were born in a humble nomad Lats village, and to what remains of Demaya, Renanus is still a sight to behold. There are less than 1,000 of you to occupy a city that once held hundreds of thousands. Ika orders everyone to take over a small complex of buildings near one of the city's greenlands. It has 16. The former inhabitants have conveniently labeled the city's buildings with a color code based on their structural soundness, since the city didn't survive the rifting entirely unscathed. Buildings marked with a green X are known to be safe. A yellow X means damage that could spell a collapse, especially if another major shake hits the city. Red-marked buildings are noticeably damaged and dangerous, though you see signs that they were inhabited too, perhaps by those willing to take any shelter rather than be ashed out. There are more than enough green X buildings for Kostrema, so every household gets its pick of apartments that are furnished, sound, and still have working hydro and geo. There are several wild flocks of chickens running about, and more goats, which have actually been breeding. The Greenland's crops are all dead, however, having gone months unwatered and untended between you killing the Rennies and Kostrema's arrival. Despite this, the seed stocks contain lots of dandelion and other hardy, low-light-tolerant edibles, including equatorial staples like taro. Meanwhile, the city's store caches are overflowing with cash bread, cheeses, fat-flecked spicy sausages, grains and fruit, herbs and leaves preserved in oil. More. Some of it's fresher than the rest, brought back by the marauding army. All of it is more than the people of Kostrema could eat if they threw a feast every night for the next 10 years. It's amazing. But there are a few catches. The first is that it's more complicated to run Renanus's water treatment facility than anyone expected. It's running automatically, and thus far hasn't broken down. But no one knows how to work the machinery if it does. Yika sets the innovators to the task of figuring that out, or coming up with a workable alternative if the equipment fails. Tonki is highly annoyed. I trained for 6 years at 7th to learn how to clean shit out of sewer water. But despite her complaining, she's on it. The second catch is that Kostrema cannot possibly guard the city's walls. The city is simply too big, and there are too few of you. You're protected for now by the fact that no one comes north if they can possibly help it. If anyone does come a-conquering, however, nothing will stand between the calm and conquest except its wall. There's no solution to this problem. Even Origins can only do so much in the martial sense, here in the shadow of the rifting, where orogeny is dangerous. Danil's army was Renanus's surplus population, and it's currently feeding a boil bug boom down in the southeastern Midlands. Not that you'd want them here anyway, treating you like the interlopers you are. Yika orders the breeders to ramp up to replacement-level production, but even if they recruit every healthy comm member to assist, Kostrema won't have enough people to secure the comm for generations. Nothing to do but at least guard the portion of the city that the comm now occupies as best you can. And if another army comes along,
you catch Ika muttering. We'll just invite them in and assign them each a room. That ought to settle it.
The third catch, and the biggest one existentially, if not logistically, is this. Kastrima must live amid the corpses of its conquered. The statues are everywhere, standing in apartment kitchens washing dishes, lying in beds that have sagged or broken beneath their stone weight, walking up the parapet steps to take over from other statues on guard duty, sitting in communal kitchens, sipping tea long since dried to dregs. They are beautiful in their way, with wild, smoky quartz manes of hair and smooth jasper skin and clothes of tourmaline or turquoise or garnet or citrine. They wear expressions that are smiles or eye rolls or yawns of boredom, because the shockwave of obelisk gate power that transformed them was fast, mercifully. They didn't even have time to be afraid. The first day, everyone edges around the statues, tries not to sit in their line of sight. To do anything else would be disrespectful. And yet, Kastrima has survived both a war that these people initiated and life as that war's refugees. It would be equally disrespectful of Kastrima's dead to let guilt eclipse this truth. So after a day or two, people start to simply accept the statues. Can't do anything else, really. Something about it bothers you, though. You find yourself wandering one night. There's a yellow X building that's not too far from the complex, and it's beautiful, with a facade covered in etched vinework and floral motifs, some glimmering with peeling gold foil. The gold foil catches the light and flickers a little as you move, its angles of reflection shifting to create the overall illusion of a building covered in living, moving greenery. It's an older building than most of those in Renanis. You like it, though you're not sure why. You go up to the roof, finding only the usual apartments inhabited by statues along the way. The door here is unlocked and stands open. Maybe someone was on the roof when the rifting struck. You check to make sure there's a lightning rod in place before you step through the door, of course. This is one of the taller buildings of the city, though it's only 6 or 7 stories altogether. Only, sneers Cyanide. Only, thinks Demaya in wonder. Yes, only, you snap at both to shut them up. There's not only a rod, there's an empty water tower. So as long as you don't go leaning on any metal surfaces or linger in the rod's immediate vicinity, you probably won't die. Probably. And here, poised to face the rifting cloud wall, as if he were built up here, gazing north, since the building's floral motifs were new, Hoa awaits. There aren't as many statues here as there should be, you say as you stop beside him. You can't help following Hoa's gaze. From here, you still can't see the rifting itself. Looks like there's a dead rainforest and some hilly ridges between the city and the monster. The wall is bad enough, however. And maybe one existential horror is easier to face than another. But you remember using the obelisk gate on these people, twisting the magic between their cells and transmuting the infinitesimal parts of them from carbon to silicate. Danil told you how crowded Renanis was, so much that it had to send out a conquering army to survive. Now, however, the city is not crowded with statues. There are signs that it was once. Statues deep in conversation with partners that seem to be missing. Only 2 people sitting at a table set for 6. In one of the bigger Green X buildings, there's a statue that is lying naked in bed, mouth open, and penis permanently stiff, and hips thrusting up, hands positioned in just the right places to grip someone's legs. He's alone, though. Someone's horrible, morbid joke. My kind are opportunistic feeders, Hoa says. Yeah,
That's exactly what you were afraid he would say.
And apparently very damned hungry? There were a lot of people here. Most of them must be missing.
We, too, put aside surplus resources for later, Aesun.
You rub your face with your one remaining hand, trying and failing to not visualize a gigantic stone-eater larder somewhere, now stuffed full of brightly colored statues.
Evil Earth. Why do you bother with me, then? I'm not as easy a meal as those.
Lesser members of my kind need to strengthen themselves. I don't.
There is a very slight shift in the inflection of Hoa's voice. By this point you know him. That was contempt. He is a proud creature, even he will admit.
They are poorly made, weak, little better than beasts. We were so lonely in those early years, and at first we had no idea what we were doing. The hungry ones are the result of our fumbling.
You waver, because you don't really want to know. But you haven't been a coward for some years now. So you steel yourself and turn to him and then say, "You're making another one now, aren't you? From me? If it's not about food for you, then it's reproduction. Horrifying reproduction, if it is dependent upon the death by petrification of a human being. And there must be more to it than just turning people to stone. You think about the Kirkuza at the roadhouse, and Jija, and the woman back in Kastrima whom you killed. You think about how you hit her, smashed her with magic, for the not crime of making you relive Uche's murder. But Alabaster was not the same in the end as what you did to that woman. She was a shining, brightly colored collection of gemstones. He was an angry lump of brown rock, and yet the brown rock was finally made, precisely crafted, careful, where the woman was a disorderly mess beneath her surface beauty. Hoa is silent in answer to your question, which is an answer in itself. And then you finally remember antimony in the moments after you closed the obelisk gate, but before you teetered into magic-traumatized slumber. Beside her, another stone-eater, strange in his whiteness, disturbing in his familiarity. Oh, evil Earth, you don't want to know, but
antimony used that too small lump of brown stone, used alabaster as raw material to make another stone-eater. And she made it look like him.
You hate antimony all over again.
He chose his own shape. We all do.
This slaps your rage out of its spiral. Your stomach clenches, this time in something other than revulsion.
That? Then
you have to take a deep breath.
Then it's him? Alabaster? He's...
You can't make yourself say the word.
Flick and Hoa faces you, expression compassionate, but somehow also warning.
The lattice doesn't always form perfectly, Aesun, he says. The tone is gentle. Even when it does, there is always loss of data.
You have no idea what this means, and yet you're shaking. Why?
You know why. Your voice rises.
Hoa, if that's alabaster, if I can talk to him.
No.
Why the rust not?
Because it must be his choice first.
Harder voice here. A reprimand. You flinch.
More importantly, because we are fragile at the beginning like all new creatures. It takes centuries for us, the who of us, to cool. Even the slightest of pressures, like you, demanding that he fit himself to your needs rather than his own, can damage the final shape of his personality.
You take a step back,
which surprises you because you hadn't realized you were getting in his face. And then you sag. Alabaster is alive, but not. Is